Hello and welcome to Willosophy with Will Anderson. I am Will Anderson from the title of the show, and I am here with my guest. I'm just going to jump straight in today. Let's not muck around too much. Guest, who are you?
My name is Greg Barrett, and I am a well-dressed shapeshifter.
Right. That would be what would be actually the definition of like a, the definition of you was well-dressed shapeshifter, what would that actually mean? If a superhero character was going to be the well-dressed shapeshifter, what are their special powers?
Their special powers are to literally morph into whatever career suits him best in the moment, and then to be as well dressed for that particular performance as possible. Like if he works at KFC, that fucking uniform is tight as shit, and he looks great in it, and the hat fits and the whole deal. And then he can easily then be in a band and look just as cool, you know. So it's sort of like I'm like I take everything very seriously. I take the uniform as seriously as the job.
I think that's a really interesting perspective. Like I genuinely do. Like, yeah. And I'm fascinated by that because I think that it will speak to, and we'll get to this in the podcast, but you have done many things and done many things excellently. Mm-hmm. And I think, and with this podcast, I don't like to presume about people. I'd rather hear it from you and talk about it in that way. But because I know you and, you know, I think there are parts of your career that have been excellent and that of your life that have been excellent that you have mixed feelings about how to reconcile.
Right.
Right. You are a person who's not known for just doing one thing. You're known for doing a lot of things. But I love that attitude of like, well, I'll do a lot of different things and I'll do a good job. But you know what you're going to know on day one? I'm going to, rock up, being prepared. I'm going to look good.
You right. Whatever the gear is, the gear's got to go along with it. I felt that way always. I feel that way about bands. I feel that way about when I go to see a stand-up. Like, the whole kit and caboodle has to work for me. From top to bottom, it all has to make sense to me. You know what I mean? Like, as a whole.
And when you
that
say
doesn't necessarily mean somebody has to come out doing stand-up in a tuxedo.
Uh-huh.
It means that the presentation has to be thought out from head to toe. The quote unquote character, which is just, we use that word because that is you are a character of yourself. Even when you're being very honest, you're still a bit of a character. The character of you makes sense to me. I look at it and I look at Will and I believe Will and I believe his clothes, and because I want as much information as possible and I want to understand you, and so the way you look tells a story, I think, as importantly as what you're saying and the way you say it. So to me that's a crucial part of all jobs, in life, even how you present yourself to your children.
I think that's really an interesting thing that you've, and like normally I would jump into the start and ask people if they have a specific philosophy, but I feel like we've already stumbled on one.
Yeah, I think we're pretty close.
Yeah, and so tell me about when you first noticed people, being well presented. Like, where did this? Because it has to have come from somewhere, right?
Well, I figured Santa Claus had it figured out,
right?
So
I mean, look at that guy. Yeah, he works one day a year. He's got a bag full of presents.
He's got it right. He picked a color. He stuck with it. He didn't change from year to year.
He's got a brand.
Yeah, he never got skinny.
Sometimes, like, the beard is shorter than the other beard. Maybe the belt is thicker or more shiny. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's rocking a bigger buckle one year.
Sure, because you got to roll with trends every once in a while. But he still was portly. He still entered through the chimney. Like, he kept most of his gig was...
It's a good mix of like what he's done, because realistically, Santa Claus could get away with a less flamboyant outfit, right?
Yeah.
I mean, technically, if you think about the role of Santa Claus,
sure,
his one mission is to sneak around the world, like on Christmas, delivering presents.
That's right.
So technically, if you're really going to Christopher Nolan the Batman story, he'd be dressed as a ninja. Because you would not want to be seen as you're going around these places, right? You would have some Batman at you going down chimneys. It's got to be very practical. There's going to be some sort of face mask.
There's a small amount of narcissism.
Right.
I'm hiding from you, but I'm not really.
Right.
And if I get caught,
I've got bells.
Look, to those who've seen me, there's a story. Right. I want there to be a legend. I am a Bigfoot. I've been seen clearly, and I've been seen in an outfit that has been repeated time and time again.
Right.
Father Christmas, and but I feel like You're right. If he was a true altruist, absolutely. The Christopher Nolan, he would also be plagued with all kinds of, you know, the reason he's giving gifts, and, you know, but he would look like a piece of coal,
right?
You know, and lithe, and you know what I mean. And
I mean, but is there any problem? This is an interesting topic of conversation too. Is there any problem? Because often you'll see people dismissed for doing good work in their own name. Mm-hmm. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I've heard people criticize, you know, their work because, well, why does he have to call it the Bill Gates Foundation? Do you know what I mean? And I'm like, because he solved malaria. That's why. Yeah. He gets, you know what? If he wants to also get a little Santa Claus glory out of it, then fair enough, I think.
Yeah, I don't think that. I don't see a problem with Bono saying, look, if you become this, here's what you can do with it.
Right.
Look what I've done. And if I did this all secretly, the way some people do, I mean, there are lots of anonymous givers in the world, but then you don't know it. And I think it's a good lesson to know. I think it's always nice to know that people give. I don't think less of somebody because they put their name on a foundation. Maybe Lance Armstrong.
Right.
I roll that back.
Right.
Well, that. But was, even yeah. he, I got to tell, well, we can talk about that in a little bit, uh-huh. but because I've just gone through this cancer thing, but I don't have a problem with that. I like knowing that people are good, and I think it's fine for somebody to have a foundation in their name, and I think it's important. Sometimes some people's names are synonymous with, you know, Ben Stiller's synonymous with Haiti, and that's his cause. And so I think that kind of thing matters. I think it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, America actually, for all the inequality that is built into the system, and maybe this is something that has arisen out of necessity, but at the top end, like, you know, the attitude to philanthropy and giving away money, if you look at people like Bill Gates and if you look at Warren Buffett and you look at some of these people who are dedicated to giving away, like, you know, massive amounts of the fortune that they've earned.
Right.
I do think that America needs to be applauded for that, and there is a public sort of tradition of it in America.
Well, there's also things that people don't understand, like the reason that art still exists is because of donors giving to museums and making sure that the art stays alive,
right?
And that films stay alive. Like the reason that we get to have some of this cool stuff, you know, is because there are wealthy people in the world who give their money to make sure museums stay open. They don't stay open on the nickels you put in when you go there, and I don't mean don't put nickels in or that doesn't count. Everything counts, but you know, that's how great collections of great artists are, right, around, is because somebody has a shit fuck of money and buys them all and preserves them and makes sure that they're cleaned and taken care of. And so yeah,
there's not somebody out the back counting the nickels going, we finally got enough, contact the Picasso estate.
right. Yeah. I mean, it is, you know, there are lots of, there are, you know, so wealthy people do some good things besides underpay their employees and ship most of the jobs overseas.
Right.
They also do that.
I mean, that's the other thing that we have to consider. Yeah, they also
yeah,
do that.
Yeah. They also do that. Yeah, I mean, I like the good wealthy, like the tennis players and stuff like that. They're not good, the rock stars. Those people are nice. But no, you know, it is true. I mean, Ben, I only know this because I know him personally. But Ben did a Haiti event in New York, and he pulled all of his artist friends because he knows people in the art world, and each one of them painted an original painting. And they raised $13 million, and it's the most amount of money ever raised in one night. And $13 million went to Haiti.
Right.
Which, I mean, Haiti could use $130 million. But that's a shit ton of power. Now, Ben didn't make a big deal about it, about himself, because he did it under some other name. But he arranged that with his power,
right,
of being famous and saying, I'm Ben Stiller, and people will pick up the phone when Ben calls.
Right.
Right. People aren't going to pick up the phone if I call. Well, no one. And I mean fucking no one. I have a hard time getting my manager on the phone. So I'm
sometimes even your voicemail doesn't answer your calls.
Yeah. No, exactly. But yeah, so I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Okay, so Santa Claus is the first well-dressed fella that you notice, but then there must be some were you a well-dressed child when you were at like primary school, or was it like something you developed in your teens or college?
I think probably Joe Namath, who was the quarterback of the Jets, who was the first NFL guy to sort of break the football rules and have long hair and wear fur coats. And
right.
He became like that to me was like, oh, there's a story.
Right.
There's a guy. That's a, like, and I was like, you know, so I was, I mean, you know, obviously I was a little boy, but I got it. And I think that was the thing that just sort of led me down the path to eventually, you know, bands, you know, seeing a band. I mean,
Before we get to the bands, because I just want to, because I was thinking about this the other day, I was watching the NBA finals. And one of the things that I realize I enjoy about the NBA is, unlike most sports in the world now, like particularly in Australia, all our sporting teams, if you ever see them, like in a post-match press conference or in a public appearance on behalf of the club, they are wearing some version of their club's uniform, whether it be like the tracksuit, you know, for actually playing, or like, you know, a club shirt or even like a club blazer, you know, they come dressed as the club uniform, right? Whereas in the NBA, when they do their post-match press conferences, they're all just dressed in their own weird ass fashion.
Right.
And it's the best.
Oh yeah.
I don't understand why we've stopped that. Seeing like someone you've just seen as a sporting god on the court looking so perfect in these well-designed uniforms and everyone's playing in unison.
Yeah.
And then they just rock up in what they picked.
Yeah.
Oh, it tells you just so much about them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In a knit cap. Right. You know what I mean? Like, no, it's style is a, you know, style is a storyteller. I liked Wimbledon whites.
Right.
I liked that Wimbledon had a rule. And then, because sometimes you leave it to these fucking tennis players and then you go, what the fuck are you wearing? What are those two colors? Once they started allowing colors in tennis, some people are great at it, but most of them are horrible. And you start looking at, you know, but then Bjorn Borg came in and changed the game. Right. He started adding checks to his whites and he had the headband and the hair long, and, you know, then Agassi came in, and, you know, and so I've always appreciated, you know, I also have always liked the trailblazer people that, you know, take it one step further and break the rules and do the thing that's unexpected or not, you know, and some people go too far. I never understood what Dennis Rodman was up to. I never got the worm. I still don't understand what he's, I don't think he gets it really. You know, so some guys go a little bit too far. Sometimes it doesn't feel genuine. I think you can also tell when something feels false.
I was reminded of a story recently, and I've told this story on my other podcast, Tofop, but I was listening to my dear friend Lima, who I used to do radio with in Australia, tell a story on another podcast, just coincidentally.
Yeah.
And he was recounting a story that happened when the two of us worked together. And to that moment, I had forgotten that story, but it has to do with Dennis Rodman. So, you know, I thought I might tell you, which is this. Apparently one day I yelled at Dennis Rodman. He came into our radio station, and I don't know why what has happened. I had blocked this story out of my mind. That's until crazy. I reheard it. But I don't know whether I was having a particularly emotional day. I was going through a pretty a tough time in my life at that period of time. So maybe I was like on the edge. But maybe I wasn't. But what had happened, I remember this, that Dennis Rodman was really drunk when he came in for a pre-record, like, you know, interview for our station. And he was flogging something terrible. You know, it was one of those ones where you had to mention the terrible thing that he was flogging to Dennis Rodman. But we're like, we'll do it. You know what I mean? We want to talk to Dennis Rodman. So Dennis Rodman comes in, he's blind drunk, and he's being a pain in the ass, like mumbling and not talking into the microphone and talking to his friends and, like, you know, just being a real, like, does not care. You know, respect.
Right.
And so I stopped the recording And I just yelled at him. I just gave him a lecture about, mate, we are here to flog your bullshit fucking product. And like, apparently was just going,
that's
like,
amazing.
No one gives a shit about it. But you know what? If you're funny and interesting and we're funny and interesting, we'll play this on the radio and we'll give it a good fucking plug. But to be honest, mate, you're wasting our fucking time. And if you don't want to talk to us, fuck off.
Oh my God, that's fantastic.
Limo's retold this story, right? And like, and apparently Dennis Rodman like really respected that.
Holy shit. I wish I had those kind of balls in my marriage.
Right. Well, I'm not sure I've ever had those balls again. Like, I think I've not
incredible.
Had those balls to the point where that story had been blocked out of my memory so yeah. that I didn't remember that I was capable of doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, anyway, I just, because you mentioned Dennis Rodman, I ended up going out for a night of drinks with Dennis Rodman.
Oh my
after
God.
This interview. So I went out on the town with Dennis Rodman. That is an incredible experience.
That's, yeah. And maybe he didn't realize what an asshole he was being. And maybe as a person who's been on both sides, you've been on both sides.
Right.
You've been the host and you've been the guest. And you know what it's like. Sometimes it's great,
right?
And sometimes it's awful. More often than not, it's not an awesome experience. And so, you know, and he probably didn't give a shit. He's not a genius of a guy. I was right. on a panel show with him once. You know, he's not one of our great thinkers. You know, he was good at rebounding.
Yeah, but again, he had a real sort of style and personality and whatever.
And for a while, he was a great basketball player. And so I've always appreciated anybody that a lot of times people equate dress with fashion or style or money, and I've always tried to say that's not what I'm talking about. Also, to me, you can do it up in a t-shirt. It's just the way you do it, and if it matches, what else you do, and you know, it's when it looks like you give a shit. You know what I mean? You know, when it looks like it's put together, there are people who can wear a t-shirt and make it still look like they give a shit. And I think that's sort of, and then you can, then, you know, then there's people where you go, well, I can tell you 10 reasons why your career isn't working, and that sweater's one of them.
Yeah, I did have a thought the other night when I was watching a particularly funny comedian here on stage, just going, you know what? I think I still would enjoy this more if you weren't wearing your bum bag, your fanny pack, as Americans would say.
Yeah.
Like on stage, just wearing it.
Yeah.
And I was like, and it wasn't like to get things out of and be part of the act. It was just like, oh no, literally, I could not find anywhere to put my fanny pack.
Yeah, I don't. That to me sounds like a nightmare. I would have probably not been able to watch the rest of the... you know, the rest of his act, that would have been hard. But then of course it was bands, and you know, and it went from Aerosmith to The Clash to, you know, the punks really did it upright. And you know,
Talk me through your personal connection to those things though. What was the first kind of music that you really like fell in love with? Where did your style, when did you start to have a distinct style of your own? Tell me a bit about that.
I think I was attracted to, because I grew up in a very white suburban, I was very preppy. I grew up very white and preppy and in a very white area. But I liked anything kind of like, so Aerosmith was it for me in 1977, 78 was exotic, and Van Halen were exotic. So I guess I liked female leaning men.
Okay.
You know, because to me that seemed like, oh, you know, you can wear a fucking scarf and big flares and your shirt's open and it looks like you might have a knife in your boot, but it also looks like you might be a lady. I thought Steven Tyler was a girl the first time I saw it. Like, I didn't quite get, like...
I mean, it was quite revolutionary in some ways, wasn't it? That these kind of, you know, heroin taking, hard drinking, you know, womanizing sort of rock and roll guys were also clearly spending hours before the show putting on makeup and doing their hair.
That's right. And you didn't have friends like that. Like, that wasn't an archetype at your school.
Right.
Like, now those archetypes exist everywhere. But that guy didn't exist. He was like like the fucking fat lady at the circus. Like, it just, they were freaks, or like seeing a ship full of pirates. Like, to me that there was a revelation of, you can still want to fuck girls and dress like that.
Right.
You can dress like Jack Sparrow and fuck chicks, and now I don't have to play sports anymore.
Right.
And that's what I choose. That's what I choose. And then my taste became more refined. And then, you know, then the Sex Pistols came along, which is all Vivian Westwood's doing, you know, I mean, she basically created that whole movement and the whole look. I mean, they were just dolls that they dressed up. I mean, the Sex Pistols themselves will tell you that they didn't pick that shit out. Those guys were just a bunch of, you know, just a bunch of blokes, and they dressed them up and it matched. It told the story. You know, I mean, you can't. Johnny Rotten was Johnny Rotten. Like, you couldn't take that. You couldn't take that away from him. Naked, he would have been fucking amazing. But you put him in that weird fuzzy sweater, and you've got him in that fucking hunch. You know, he looks like a hunchback, and there was just something about it that made that part of the story made it even more interesting. And so to me, then that started to inform my dress, because I couldn't pull the Aerosmith thing off. I just didn't have. I don't have those kind of cheekbones,
right.
And I could never get that skinny.
Right.
You know what I mean? So I started to lean towards the punk thing a little bit more, because I could pull off a short, spiky haircut, and you know, I could pull off a short sleeve, you know, I could have like a ripped T-shirt and that kind of thing.
And so, where in your life are you at when, you know, around
college.
This, like you're at college, right?
Yeah.
And so are there plenty of other people who are also kind of into that scene and dressing like that, or is it still a bit unusual?
No, I make my first gay friend, and he's not out yet, but that's so funny, because I was like, oh, finally another straight guy that gets it. Truly. And we'd go thrift store shopping, and he was the one that turned me on to all the cool music, and he turned me on to all the clothes. And
I think we would have had equality, by the way, a lot earlier if you had gone out in public with the slogan, gay guys, they're just a straight guy who gets it.
Yeah, that's it. They're just a straight guy that gets it. That's all. So my friend Larry, and so he just had just fucking mad taste. And so we would go out and thrift store shop and buy old men's clothes and like rip the cuffs off and wear. I mean, I still wear, you know, I would wear old brogues, and I would dress like the record store clerks, you know. And I went to school in Eugene, Oregon, which was very cold. So that's why I started wearing the cardigans. You know, you buy old man's shit. That's why the cardigans was the, you know, not because I had some love for sweater. I just,
right.
That was the sweater that you could buy at
thrift
stores.
Because granddad died.
That's right.
Right.
And there they were. And it smelled, but they were great. And you put your jam pin on, and then Bob's your uncle, you know. And so that's, and I sort of stayed there. I kind of lived in that area. Then I sort of like, because it was easier to go punk for me and a little rockabilly. I'd roll my jeans, and I bought the engineer boots, and I'd wear the flannels and that kind of thing. And I started putting my hair back. So it was sort of a punk thing. I never, you know, I trust me, if I could have pulled off Adam Ant, I'd have done it.
Right.
I mean, I admired those guys. I loved Adam Ant.
So many people pulled off Adam Ant during that time, and you were the only one who couldn't.
I couldn't. I was the only guy that couldn't do it. I mean, I really did love that stuff. I really loved him for being that. I always thought about, you know, Bow Wow Wow, same thing. I loved the Mohawks and the face paint and the pirate's pants. Like, I just thought, you know, that's a show. That's a thing, you know. And again, very exotic for our time period. Very, very exotic. I mean, you know, if you had pink shoelaces, somebody would call you a faggot.
Right.
Like, it was, no, I mean, people would question you. No, right. You would get punched. Like, Larry grew up getting beat up daily. Like,
yeah.
Just for having wayfarers. Like, I mean, you know, those were times where, you know, you hear like Dave Grohl and those guys tell the stories of like, if you had punk records, you got beat up. But if you had punk records, you got beat up or called faggot or whatever. And I was always pretty beefy, so I never really got, I never got a lot of heat. But I still didn't like being called queer or faggot or whatever because, you know, but once I had a friend who was also wearing what I was wearing, I felt like a little bit more strength in numbers.
Right.
We're both being called faggot.
Yeah.
But Larry's actually gay.
Right.
But I didn't know. And that was you. And yeah, I say,
those
and
guys
I,
knew.
And I used that word, which I know is not the right word, but that was the word being used at the time. You know, that's how hateful people were. And
oh,
so
also, I think that there's a difference between, and that's an interesting point, because I've noticed that they're censoring a lot of literature now. In fact, there are things that won't get played anymore because, you know, there's people using the N-word in them or whatever.
Right.
And I think as historical documents... Like if, but you know, we should show what You know, like Huck Finn's a good example. They're constantly trying to, like, you know, censor Huck Finn. But it's a story of that time.
How do you...
And the way they use language in that time and the fact that we don't think it's appropriate now informs it. If you listen to episodes of Tofop, and I know that actually this was the same with Walking the Room because you guys went through the same thing. In the period of time we had both been doing those podcasts, 4 years, like mm-hmm. maximum, right? The way that we talk about transgender issues and transgender people has changed.
100%.
And there would be things that are said on those earlier podcasts that only 3 or 4 years ago I was ignorant enough to not, you know, understand. But it's been easy to change.
And it wasn't like, I mean, even... the first time Dave and I, or the maybe the... I don't remember. I can't remember. But it was early on when we threw the word tranny out thinking that was the word.
Right.
Or shemale. I mean, I don't think we knew what the right word were it was, and we certainly didn't mean to be offensive, but we did mean to be funny, and it was offensive, I think, and when we did it, and we got schooled, and then we said, fair enough. You know, it didn't feel like political correctness. It felt like, hey, that community also has feelings, and but to take away the language in a book would be like, if at your house where your mom marked every year how tall you were, and then we just erased all the inches, and right. then just you were just always
you were
6'2".
Always this tall.
It's absurd, and it's interesting to go back and read that stuff because we didn't, you know, in that time period, because I'm 50, I'll be 52 next week. In that time period, we just didn't. No, certain things were wrong, and everyone was okay with it.
Right.
Including black people and Hispanic people. We were all signed off on it as we were still trying to continue growth. Those movements were happening, and we were still like feminism was happening, and we were demeaning women on television.
Right.
Right. I just watched...
You mean today, right?
Yes.
And yesterday.
Every minute.
And for the always. Foreseeable future.
I just watched the musical How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, and they have a song on there called Your Secretary is Not a Toy. It is fucking hilarious. And really, when you watch it, you realize Matthew Weiner must have watched it 1,000 times before he made Mad Men, and that's why he put Robert Morse in Mad Men. But it's a very funny musical, and it's so telling. But I do think that, like, it's, you know, they're not going to show the Dukes of Hazzard anymore,
right?
Because that flag's on the car, and yet there's nothing racist about those two guys or that show. So you have to go, okay, well, there's a case where they don't show the car that much, and that's not the same as still flying the flag over the state capitol.
Right.
There's a big difference.
I mean,
they'll go back to all the Lynyrd Skynyrd records.
Right.
And all the bottles of Jack Daniels. Like, we changed. We all acknowledged the change. We didn't think it was wrong, or we didn't get that it was wrong, or a lot of people didn't get that it was wrong. A lot of people did. And eventually something happened because we didn't want to change our gun laws.
Right.
9 people were shot, so we got rid of a flag. We did it again, America. We did it again. And guns win the day. Worst.
9 people get shot and you get rid of the Dukes of Hazzard.
We get rid of the Dukes of Hazzard. 9 people get shot in a church and we get rid of the Dukes of Hazzard. We are...
You know what? Stop shooting people or we'll put mash on the table. That's what was there.
It's... And you know, it's so funny, you know, the president just used the N-word on Mark Maron's podcast.
Yep.
And when I listened to the interview, he said it so casually and so comfortably, and he was using it in context. And so, you know, it's a word, and it's a word that you can't get rid of it as a word. And it's a word that needs to be discussed, and it's a piece of history that we need to use the word sometimes to discuss history.
Because in the context he used it, I believe it's in the context of saying, just, you know, well, can you, are you able to paraphrase? No, mm-hmm. Neither of us can. Here's what I will do. People can listen to the interview and get in the context, but essentially he's saying, just because somebody's being called that word in the street and then goes on to speak to other issues, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's in the context of, you know, referencing somebody calling a black person that word. He couldn't just say, if someone's calling a black person a bad word or the N-word. Like, that word still is the word that is most used to demean black people, right?
Yes. Yeah.
That's the word to use. But the thing that's most interesting about that to me is he's not the first American president to use that word in public. Like, there's 4 or 5 previous American presidents who used it, but in the other context.
Yes. Oh, so, oh yes.
So, you know, if we're going to have the ones who used it in that context, then have the new one who, you know, this is a great moment for America where, you know, really for the first time it's been used by a president, you know, in a way that isn't derogatory.
And I just love that he did it on a podcast.
On a podcast.
Because where are you going to do it? It's on a podcast. And I also love that he...
Mark Maron's podcast.
Yeah, he almost... I mean, it was funny because...
it's a very good interview, but I can't believe Maron didn't bring up that beef they had at New Faces in Montreal. I mean, that's what I wanted it to be about. I wanted it to be a classic Mark Maron interview.
Do you remember that time? Time where, like, you wouldn't talk to me and... But it would be the other way around. It would be Obama going, "You were such a dick."
Right.
"You were such a dick to me at New Faces. I remember because I was going on after you, and you were trying to fucking psych me out, and you kept walking back and forth going, oh, you're that guy. You're going to do this stuff. You're going to do the black stuff?"
Right.
You remember, you said to me, yes, we can.
That's what you're closing on?
Yeah. Or you're going to close on hope.
Hope.
It's... That would have been beautiful. Yeah. No, the president definitely came to play as he, I'm surprised none of you have talked about this, is he basically admitted he has no religious affiliation whatsoever.
It's one of those things where thank God, I was going to say ironically, but I think anyone who listens to anything he says understands that Barack Obama is smart enough to, you know, have at least skepticism about there being, you know, one particular God from, you know, a particular, you know, one particular book. Everything that he's said and done really has said that, but he's never been able to say it.
But it's almost like he was close enough to go, of course I'm in the pocket of big insurance. How do you think you get elected president?
Right.
How do you think?
It'd be great if he just really had gone through all of them.
Do you really think the first black president is not also going to be a hawk?
Right.
You think I'm going to pull those drones? I mean, do you understand the responsibility on my shoulders for all black politicians, not only black? You know, when people say I don't do enough for black people, I'm really doing it by being the president in a hawkish way.
Right.
You know, they can call me a socialist, but when they look at my record and look at what I did, and yes, I'm a hawk, and yes, the drones are awful, and yes, we're trying to figure out how to keep guys out of battle at the same time, and yes, we're in places we shouldn't be, but there's also a lot I can't do about it. And I have no truck with Congress, because Congress are a bunch of racist assholes.
Right.
And I basically, I'd love to come out and say what I really said. I mean, I'd love to be at a conversation like that. I mean, that was close, but I really would love to be, you know, in a conversation at a dinner. I think I've said this to you before, where it's just Bill Clinton and Barack Obama just going, holy shit, that job, and just hear them both talk about what can't get done and why it can't get done, and
our friend Dave Anthony said something interesting to me, because Dave has not necessarily been a fan of Obama as president,
but
he said that he thinks he'll make a great former president. You know, he thinks he'll be one of those people that, you know, because even you can see it even in this last year. Like, you know, on the guns issue the other day, when he was really just honest about the fact that Americans have to stop shooting each other. And he started to really kind of like say, be a bit more honest, even going on Maron's podcast, that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I feel like when he's out of the job, he might be one of those guys who does, A, become a real leader for, you know, all sorts of groups and people, you know, because he can. Because he's still going to be young. He's a powerful, powerful speaker.
Yes.
You know, I don't think anyone doubts the fact that he can tell a great speech and he can, you know, word things in a really inspirational way. You know, maybe they'll doubt him on follow through or what he actually did. But, you know, there's no better speaker in the world. And once you're out and you have a bit more freedom to literally commentate on these things, I think, you know, he might be a really powerful voice in the world.
And also, when he leaves, his legacy, he'll be attributed things that he didn't even necessarily do but happened under his under his regime.
Legalizing marriage equality, for example, which really...
Right.
You know,
and the pot laws beginning to change and getting Osama bin Laden, which he did do. Like, a lot of cool, he got a lot done, and he didn't get a lot done, and there was some effectiveness and there wasn't effectiveness. I mean, the guns thing's gotten so out of control that you do start to think, like, fucking, how can you guys not get your hands on this? And then you watch a president who is anti-gun, not, and the conversation's always the same, which is, you know, and I'm sure you guys are tired of hearing this, but it's the same, the conversation. We should probably, you know, set some rules. You're not taking our fucking guns.
Right.
Now, I never said I wanted to take your guns. No, it starts there and then you take the guns. I'm just saying maybe we should have a rule on how easy it is to get a semi-automatic, a machine gun.
Can we just have like a sleep on it rule? Can we have a sleep on it overnight rule?
Could a retard not get a shotgun immediately?
Right.
It's really, by the way, I'm mentally handicapped again with the language. I'm old and some of those words still feel fun to say in a comedic context.
Okay. So as an ex-president, because he is younger and he's a bit more tapped into all these sort of things. And the thing that I think that Americans probably don't appreciate is Obama's incredibly popular around the world. The good PR that he's done for America's brand.
Yes.
Even if like in a domestic sense.
Yes.
Like, yeah, he's got a bit of America's swing back internationally. Like people have liked him.
Yeah. I find his, now if we return to our initial conversation, I find his dress as a president to be spectacular. I find all of his other clothing choices to be almost as though he's mocking blue collar America.
Right.
He dresses consciously bad. He's got way cooler friends than that. And he wears giant sleeves and huge pants. And he looks horrible.
It's almost like he's afraid of looking too stylish or sharp.
Yeah, and he's got a fantastic body, and he could wear the best clothes. Right. He's an amazing
shape. And he's wearing those mom jeans.
And he wears the mom jeans and the gigantic shirts that are three sizes too big, and he wears bad puffy jackets and bad running shoes, and there's just that thing of like, and I know you know you're better than that. You can't be friends with Jay-Z and dress like that. Like, you just can't. You can't.
Right, but you can't wear a suit the way that he wears a suit. And he wears some stylish suits, particularly when he's like getting dressed up for a talk show or something like that. And he puts on his I want to look good suit.
Oh, man.
Like, he's a stylish looking dude.
He dresses like one of the Rat Pack.
Right.
And he's got that kind of patter. He comes out and he knows how to be funny like one of those guys. I mean, he's by far the funniest president we've ever had. Yep. And he gets it. And he loves comedy, obviously.
Well, the funniest intentionally funny president that you've had.
Yes.
I mean, George W. Bush.
The funniest president.
The funny president.
That's ever lived.
Like, hands down.
That has ever lived. Just fascinating. I mean, scary as it's happening. Funny in retrospect.
Right.
But I find his... At least he wears his fucking cowboy boots. Like, I find his post-presidential I'm a cowboy thing more real than Obama's aren't I regular? No. Michelle pulls it off in the J. Crew stuff. She looks fantastic. Michelle dresses great no matter where she goes. And the girls are always going to be styly because they're young girls. But Obama,
I saw a thing with her the other day. She's like kickboxing or something now, Michelle Obama, and there was like footage of her. Like, and you know, sometimes when you see those sort of things, you're like, but it honestly looked like she was training for a remake of like The Dark Knight Rises. Like, it was, she was going to be in the League of Shadows. It was proper or UFC or something. I was like, you're pretty action.
Oh yeah. She's pretty. No. You know, they're both super intelligent. Now they're gonna be missed. They're gonna be missed because whoever comes in next, it's gonna be strange. I mean, it's probably gonna be Hillary. I don't think it's gonna be Bernie Sanders, although he is pretty cool. But I don't think it's gonna be Jeb Bush. I don't think they've got a shot. But it's gonna be. I don't know. I worry.
Are politics a thing that you are interested in? Have they been that you have been interested in? Are you more or less interested in as like you know as your life goes on than you were before? Tell me about that.
I think I became more interested in them when I got married and started to have a family and started to make some money and started to become a little bit more socially aware. But I was never really super interested in them. I don't feel like there's, I feel like a spectator, you know, I don't feel like there's much, I don't feel like I can make real change. You know, I feel like I should just go do my job really, really well and see if that contribution is to do what I do, and to do it really well and to raise my girls to be good girls and to be a good husband and sort of like, so I don't, you know,
Well, talk.
I lived it, but I, you know, that's because I live in Los Angeles, which is a hopeless fucking place.
Right.
It doesn't feel like a community. It's like it's just a bunch of streets plopped down on some sand. It's a horrible fucking grid of empty souls trying to get on television. of which I am one. And yet I've made some of the best friends of my life here, and I love some of it very, very much. But I think if I lived in a smaller place where I felt like if I lived in a smaller town, or even if I lived in a place like Portland,
right,
I think maybe I'd feel differently.
It was interesting. It's funny that you say that about Portland. We were in Portland last week for a week and had just the best time. I love that city mm-hmm. so much. Mm-hmm. And it's just a city that like all the things that I like to do, it does.
Yeah.
And it does it in a way that you do feel like you're part of a community, you yes. know? Like, I was there for a week, but I was going to the same place to get coffee every day, and by the end of the week, you felt like, I like, you know, we know that each other and that, you know, you kind of have a little routine and stuff. We went on a Monday night to, on a Wednesday night, they have at the race park, I guess it's called, like outside Portland, their international raceway. They have drag racing, but like it's just people who have old classic cars who live around Portland and they all like bring their cars out and they just sit around in this field with these cars and there's like a band and there's like you can buy a bit of pizza or whatever. But essentially, it's just a few hundred people and everyone goes around and looks at everyone else's cars and they've all got their like bonnets open and whatever. And so we're walking around this thing, you know, and there's like these old, you know, kind of like fat car-y guys, you know, drinking beers and sitting by their car. But we go up and they'd let us, you know, sit in the car and they'd turn on the engine and they'd show you what was going on. Like, I mean, it felt like a community event, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, they're drag racing against each other down the strip and stuff. And I was like, this, like, I haven't been to anything like that in LA.
No, and that's...
And I'm sure there are things like that that happen, by the way.
They do it at Bob's Big Boy on every Friday night. They park cars out there. But you just don't... It doesn't have that feel, and it doesn't... It's too sprawling. It's just a factory. And we're all on the factory floor. It's just a gigantic factory that makes show business, and we're all at work all the time, and you run into people that you know at work. This is just a giant workplace. I mean, I don't feel... And it's transient, because nobody wants to stay here, really. I think everybody kind of wants to come in and maybe get a little piece of something and then see when they can leave.
Right.
You know.
Hi, I've come with a bag this big.
Yeah.
Could you fill it up this much?
Yeah.
And then I'll leave.
Yeah. And maybe that's been my problem career-wise. You know, maybe I look like I want to go. And that has made people go, well, how long is he going to stick around? But it is it's a very unforgiving and very non-communal feeling place. There's a good community within the show business crowd,
right?
For sure.
Well, I think that's different in some ways because people have come together here. Like, as in, like I found it a very welcoming community to be part of, and the reason that I explain, I think at least part of it is that no one is really from here. You know, if I went to Boston or if I went to San Francisco or if I went to Portland or whatever and wanted to do comedy there, like most of the people who are doing comedy there are from those places, you know? Right. Or they've moved maybe from a smaller place to that place, but they become part of that, you know, community that's manageable enough that everyone kind of knows each other and sees each other. But it's so big here and it's so many imports from different places that I actually just find it very easy because people are like, well, there's no clicky clicks in the same way. I'm sure there are, but it's a bit more diluted and people are a bit, you know, they're all kind of tourists here. So people tend to be a little easier to be friends with, I think.
Yeah. And also, it's also, sometimes you want people to cling to, because it's scary here. sometimes. And it's nice to be able to say to somebody, oh, fuck, I've been swimming in it too.
Right.
And, well, it, you know, I had a bad audition, or I had a bad, you know, I haven't been able to, you know, get past this point in my career, or this, I'm having this dip, or I'm having this moment that's great, or whatever. Or I'm trying to rebuild, or what, you know, there's all different versions of a career if you're at it long enough. You know, but ultimately, and so the only people that can relate to that are the your peer group. You know, you have that conversation with somebody who works a regular job, and they can't completely get that because they do the same thing for a long time, and they don't have upswings and downswings the way we do, and they don't, they get to go to work on Monday, and we sometimes don't get to go to work in 2015. So it's a whole, you know... Or sometimes we have all of our stuff booked out in 2015 and we wake up with a belly full of cancer, and now that's canceled and the cancer bills are coming in. So that's, I mean, sometimes that also happens.
All right. Well, yeah, I mean, we've talked about a lot of other things, and there are other things I want to talk about, but like there's, you know, you've mentioned the cancer a couple of times. So right. Let's talk about like whatever you would like to talk about relation to
it's
that.
It's easy. I, you know, when, I'm certain some of the people that listen to this podcast may have seen me. I had at least 40 people total at the 8 shows I performed.
Well, tell me this.
A lot of people came to the gala.
Was there more payers to your show than there were tumors inside your body?
Yes. Okay. Oh, yes.
Right.
Oh,
well, that's, yes. I mean, so that's
the okay ratio. Yeah, the ratio was.
That's fine.
I had a hell of a gala set.
Right.
I had a great, great gala set. I loved it. And
so
we'll take
everyone back. It's April. You're in Melbourne doing the Melbourne International Comedy Festival.
Yeah, I'm there. And I had some stomach aches before I left. And they just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And Anthony and I did our very final Walking the Room podcast, which we decided to do in Australia for some reason. We just said, well, we're both there. Let's do it there. And then that night, my stomach felt like it was just, I felt like something had exploded inside of me. I just read the bass player from Guns N' Roses, Duff McKagan's biography, where he actually describes what it was like for his pancreas to burst. And I was like, well, that must be it. Something like that happened. So I call the festival, and they send somebody right over, and they take me to the hospital. And everyone is just, well, everyone there is Australian. So right. I wanted you to do this the other night. I talked about this at Largo, but I wanted you to do the voice because I can't do the Australian accent. But I basically, I was in agony, and they gave me morphine. It didn't work. They gave me more morphine. It didn't work. They gave me some Dilaudid. It started to feel better. They gave me some more Dilaudid, and then they gave me a CAT scan. And then I took a heroin nap for 4 hours. and I woke up, and the guy said, this is what I wanted you to say. Well, it's not an ulcer. And you don't have a stomach ache, but you've got a cluster of tumors in your belly, and it might be cancer. But it's all up. So tumor and cluster right. And cancer, and then he put mate at the end. He was a fucking 26-year-old surgeon.
Right.
And
that's reassuring in Australia.
And I was like, man, if you get cancer, get it in Australia, because it just doesn't sound that bad. It really didn't. And then the first thing out of my mouth was, the very first thing I said was, well, you know, I've had a pretty good life. I really have. I married the right woman, and I've had a really neat career. And the guy goes, well, we're not picking out headstones yet, bro. And so... He said, "We don't know what this is. We don't know. It was just they're there and they're in your belly."
He signals to another doctor who was bringing in headstones.
get out.
He's taking it hard, Larry. Right.
So then he asked me to come look at X-rays, and then I was like, "You show me a plate of spaghetti."
So, what's in your mind at this moment? Like, literally, can you remember what your state of mind was? I mean, were you?
I thought, you know, this is one of those. I thought I didn't understand where they really were because I was still too high, and they were in my aorta going into my intestine. But I thought he meant that they're in my heart and in my intestines.
Right.
So I thought, I have a bunch of them and I'm going to die. Yep. They're just everywhere, and we caught it too late. So I thought I was going to die. But I was remarkably unafraid to die. I'm very unafraid to die. But I just felt like because I really do feel like I have done so much cool shit in my life. And I have two remarkable children that love me. And my wife is a fucking warrior. And she'll get through this. And the kids will have a nice life. And she'll probably get a halfway decent husband at the end that she can have for the rest of her life after this. And my insurance policy is through the fucking roof. So, you know, it's a bummer for a summer. But then the bonus is nice for the whole family. So I did have a little bit of, fearlessness about it. So I thought I was pretty sure that I was going to die. So
A person who has death been present in your mind, in your life? Like, I mean, you know, we mentioned Marc Maron earlier, and I think he'd be the first to admit that he, you know, it's almost like totally present in his life. That, you know, this kind of idea of death almost drives everything else, you know, that he does. Were you a person who's thought about death much before that moment?
I think I probably thought about it an average amount. Right. You know, I thought about it, and I think I would think about it when things were going pretty well. But no, not a ton.
Okay.
I really haven't had a big fear of it, and I just experienced the most agonizing pain that I've ever experienced. Like, I take a shot in the face from Tyson and say that was nothing compared to what was going on in my stomach. You could marathon man all my gums, and I could take it. Like, so I just felt like, you know, I have been given, you know, I loved my parents. My dad's still alive, but I love my parents, and I had a good upbringing as far as those kind of things grew. I grew up in a very madmanish time, so there was a lot of drinking and stuff. And my parents, it's like we were talking about earlier, you know, sometimes you just didn't know any better.
Right.
People know better now. But so I call my wife, and she is very much a man of action. And so she's like, okay. You know, well, because they say to me, well, you need to go home. And I go to my apartment, and they go, no further.
Right.
Back to America now, like as soon as possible, and go to a hospital. We've done all the work, so they don't take these x-rays and go to emergency and get operated on immediately. And so I was like, okay. And so I called my wife, and she was very business. Okay.
So tell me about that. Like, did you prepare before you called her? Did you kind of say in my head, this is what I will tell her? Or did you just think, I've just got to talk to her and we'll see how that goes?
Yeah, I just dialed her.
Do you go with it straight away? Like, is it the first thing you say in that situation? Because it's hard to make small talk, I imagine.
Well, yeah, because it's 3 o'clock in the morning here. And I say, hey, listen, I got some pretty bad news. And remember, I'm still super fucking high.
Yeah.
And I say, I have some pretty bad news. Those stomach aches turned out to be cancer, and there's on my aorta and in my belly. And I didn't really give her, I should have let her talk to the doctor.
Right.
And I have to go to emergency, right away, but in America. So she's like, like it's a lot to swallow.
Right.
And she goes, well, what has to happen? And I said, the doctor, you have to call my regular doctor, and he has to get us a cancer doctor, and we got to go to Cedars when I get home, right from the airport. And she was like, okay, I love you, and love you too, blah, 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 blah. She was very, you know, loving, but very, like, you know, trying to figure shit out, you know, and very sort of, you know, businessy. I called my manager, and he burst into tears. I'm like, right. That's... I feel like
the
scripts got switched.
Yeah.
But that just is the way my wife is.
So now she's managing you, and you're living with him.
That's right. I'm living with him. It would be easier. She'd take my calls at least. No, he's fantastic. He's we have the same manager, and yes. He's a very emotional guy and a lovely, lovely guy, and he struggled with his own illnesses from time to time, and so he was very upset. And he just got choked up, and I said, I need to go home, and I need one of our other managers was there, Jake, and I said, Jake can't go home tonight on his flight. He has to go home with me tomorrow because I can't get myself on an airplane because they have given me the largest box of OxyContin imaginable,
right.
And also some shots that I'm supposed to give myself every couple of hours to thin my blood so that doesn't clot, and I need someone to get me on a plane.
Those two, and also those one of those things might give me trouble with the other one of those things.
Yeah, and it's all and I can't.
And by the way, can I ask this? Because I mean, you know, you're sober.
Yeah.
Right. Is there any issues with, like, I mean, obviously you need to be taking OxyContin and yeah. you need to be taking morphine for your pain and stuff. Yep. But is there any worries or issues when you're going through something like that when you have been sober or not? I genuinely don't know what the answer to that is.
I sort of felt like cancer trumps sober.
Yeah. I guess that's what I was asking.
These pills last like 6 hours. Yep. They're super strong. And I'll just take them as prescribed, and I'll right. give them, and I gave them to Jake, and said, just give me one when I'm supposed to take one, and they were really strong. And so then I started nodding out when he and I were having lunch, but then I was all packed and everything, and I'm like, well, I'm not going to sit in my fucking apartment and feel sorry for myself,
there are people who probably don't who listen to this podcast who probably I know from the numbers of people who listen to this podcast, there are people who listen to this podcast who have no awareness of my other podcasts. It's called Tofop. You should listen to it.
It's really good.
There's 300 episodes of it. But anyway, more people listen to this one, so I need to explain this to them. Many years ago, 4 years ago, I think it was, we did your podcast, Walking the Room, with Dave and Charlie and I. We did a thing called Superpod at the Melbourne International Comedy Festival, and it was one of the most brilliant, fun nights of comedy that we'd all been involved in.
Yeah.
We didn't know what it was going to be, and it was something amazing.
We hadn't planned anything, and Charlie brought out a piece of paper with his first night of stand-up that he'd ever done. And he started to read his stand-up as written, and then that was it.
That was it.
The rest of the night. And we all laughed, and it was beautiful. It was really, really good. So we thought, well, let's try it again and see if it works.
Well, it didn't record. That's what people said.
Oh, yeah, so,
know.
Yeah, that's
it
right.
It did not record.
Yeah, we do this. We have this night. It is an amazing night. And, of course, the podcasts had both been friendly for a long time and why Dave and I are known in Australia. So we record this thing. It's going to be epic. And it didn't record. So it became even more legendary.
Right. So you guys were back in the country. Charlie and I had already booked in to do a live TOEFOP at the Melbourne Comedy Festival.
Right. We just ended Walking the Room for good.
So I hit you guys up and I said, what about we don't tell anybody, but we make it, instead of it being a TOEFOP live, we make it Superpod 2. Because most of the people who are going to come would be aware of that and know about that. And I thought this will just be one of those really cool moments no one expects, and it'll be brilliant.
Yeah.
And then on the day that we're going to do this, we've managed to keep it a secret for all this time. No one knows it's going to happen.
No.
And then you go and get cats.
I go get cancer. I go out and get myself a whole bunch of cancer. But I'm all cheery about it because I'm high, and I tell you guys, and so everyone has different reactions to it. But I'm like, I'm good. Like, I'm good to go. And we had a great show. Another fantastic show, as I recall.
Well, as I said on the night, like it was the first time that I've done one of those live shows where I wasn't the most high person, so that was good.
Yeah.
That's a new record for the show.
Yeah.
It was for me, and this is what I was, because the Comedy Festival had contacted me, because I'd been in contact with you, but the Comedy Festival had also been back channeling me and giving me a bit more of a, like, you know, he's not really well, and if, you know, he may not be able to do the show tonight. And I was like, well, of course, if he can't do the show, people don't even know he's meant to be doing the show.
Yeah.
You know, like, so literally if he can't do it, it's only really going to be, you know, like, in my mind, I was just putting myself into your situation. And if I was in your situation and I had been told that I was sick and I was going back home with some, like, just an open diagnosis of what, you know, the next few months were going to be like, and if I was in any state to be doing a show in a place where I was going to get nothing but love and support, that's what I would want to do with my last
100%
time.
I was like, this could be the last comedy show I ever do.
Right.
So,
or the last one you get to do in Australia or whatever.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah. They're not inviting me back.
Right.
If you saw I Am the King sweater, you are, yeah, that's going to be a heart. So anyway, then I get on the airplane. So then the show goes fantastic.
Right.
And I go back home, and it's like, and then we had a really early flight, and I get on the plane, and they can't get Jake to sit with me in first class, so they have to give me all my own pills. And Jake goes in the back, and I'm sitting next to the drummer of a band called Switchfoot, and they're an American rock and roll band that play all over the world because they are surfers and they're Christians, and they basically use their band. I mean, they write pretty good. They write great songs. They're like a fine band,
right?
They're not an amazing band, and they're definitely not a terrible band. They're a very good band, and they've got a big Christian following, and they have a huge surfing following, and they use their band to travel the world to surf.
Right.
They're probably more surfer than they are Christian. So the dude sitting next to me that's a drummer, and obviously we're coming back from Australia, and they had been all around at the Pacific Rim. They've been all over the place. And I say to the guy, we sort of get friendly, and I say to him, now listen to me. I'm possibly sick. I might have a touch of cancer, which it made him laugh. And I said, I have to take these pills. And once I've taken these pills, it's very possible that I will tell you that I love you or that you're my best friend. I might take my shirt off and go for a walk. Like, I don't know what's going to happen, but if you could keep your eye on me,
right,
I'd appreciate it, because I'm already high. And I ended up just taking one pill and falling fast asleep. Uh-huh. And I slept the whole flight and woke up like with an hour. And then we chatted a bit. And then he walked me to baggage claim and said, they told me that he loved me and that he'd said a prayer for me and that I was going to be fine. And then Amira picked me up and took me to the hospital, and we went right into surgery. And within 24 hours, I found out that I had a non-Hodgkin's B-cell lymphoma, which is what you want.
Okay.
Like, I got one of the cancers you want that they know something about. Because as of last Friday, after four rounds...
And when you say the ones you want, you mean if you're going to get cancer.
If you're
going
to get cancer.
You don't want them.
You don't want any cancers.
No. But if you have to have a cancer,
but
this is...
All the doctors were pleased with the cancer that I had.
Right.
Then they'd gone in and taken my appendix out, and also, because they just took it out. I'm not even sure. Maybe they just got it out of the way and decided not to put it back in.
I think they were having a sale.
But they had to take out my entire, you know, they had to take out my intestine and, you know, like, and then put it all back in, which it's weird to think about that, because you think, is it in there arbitrarily, or does it fold the same? Can you refold it and put it back in?
Are you thinking that it's like what, it's one of those things that once you've undone, it's like a computer cord. You can never like put it up the right way.
Yeah. Or like
the cords for your amp or something.
Yeah. Or one of those like magazine things that you unfold it once, like a map, and then you can't refold the map. You can never can refold it back the way it goes.
You're essentially doing origami for 45 minutes.
And by the way, guys, a map was a thing we used to not have on a phone. It was made of paper. And they showed you where you went, and you had to figure it out yourself, longitude and latitude. So they found what the cancer was, and they said, but it's very aggressive. It wants to do business.
Mm.
And
that's
so
not good news.
We'd like to get in there and do chemo quickly. So
so this is a big deal, right? Because again, like all I know, I mean, everyone has like connections with cancer because it is so prevalent in all its different forms. But at the same time, it's not necessarily something that people, you know, talk about all the time or whatever. So, but you hear terrible things about chemo. Like, is it terrible?
Well, here, my experience has been this. No.
Okay.
My experience has been that it's not that terrible. I mean, they have so many anti-nausea drugs that they shoot into you as they're doing all the chemo, and they have pills for you to take. The thing that's hard about it, and it's everybody's different, every human being's different. The thing that's hard about it is the flu-like feelings that you get every once in a while, the lethargy. You know, you get up a flight of stairs and you can barely breathe. You want to lay down a lot. My brain was never tired.
Okay.
I've never written more because I can't go anywhere. So I just put my computer. I've done more work in this past 3 months than I've done maybe my entire show business life.
Right.
So it hasn't been. The first weekend was bad because they didn't give me the right drugs, and I threw up a lot, and I got very very sick, and I had to go back to the hospital, and then because I'd split my stitches open, and then they had to sew me back up. And then they said, we didn't give you the right stuff. So they gave me the right stuff, and I'm fine. It's advancing every day. They're getting better at cancer, you know? And I ended up having one that's fairly treatable. So, I've had 4 rounds of cancer. Of course, my hair fell out. They literally said it'll be like 2 weeks, and 2 weeks to the day. I cut a mohawk because
talk to me about the hair, because like your hair, you know, is something that you clearly like, you like, you know, playing with.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm the same. I love hair. I've always had different color hair, different styles of hair. Like, you know, I love a dude with a cool haircut, and I like someone who's like got a good hairstyle. Yeah. So for me, like, it would be that thing of going, oh yeah, right, I'm going to lose all my hair. Was that a big deal for you at all? Or is everything else that's happening, it just makes it not
you
care?
I mean, you just have to get rid of your dignity. You just have to go, look,
right,
that shit is off the table. I mean, I had a woman come in and say, we need to Q-tip your nose and your asshole because you went to the hospital and came back. And so you may have picked up a bug, but we have to Q-tip your asshole. And she was a Thai woman, and her name was Rose. And then she brought in a nursing student with her to do it.
Right.
And I said, why not bring in a nursing student? Right. I was like, anybody wants to look at my asshole, it's a good one, you know? And so you don't, and I don't like to, I'm a guy that like really doesn't like to take his shirt off at the beach. Like I'm just not that, that's not one of my vanities.
Right.
So, but you just lose all that shit. So I cut a mohawk so it wouldn't be so drastic for my girls to watch like clumps of hair fall out of me. And then the mohawk just thinned and thinned and thinned, and then I eventually just shaved it off. But the reason that you lose your hair is not because you're sick. It's because cancer, because chemotherapy kills fast-growing cells.
Right.
And it's not arbitrary. It just goes after any fast-growing cell. They're just looking around for anything that could be cancer. You know, they're getting to the point now where they have, I took a second drug that went just after the lymphoma called Rituxan. And that's probably the drug that did the most damage to it. That's like a ground attack. But then your hair just starts to fall out. So I was like, well, there it goes. You know, I mean, do I want my hair back? Of course. I miss it. But at the same time, I prefer having my life back. So,
right.
You know, and I like a hat.
Right.
You
that
know,
is. I mean, that is a good thing. You've always like been a man who's liked a hat.
Yeah, I like a hat, and I have a lot of them.
And also now in a comedic sense, like with the hat, it's part of the act, you know, because you can have a reveal.
Yeah, exactly. And if somebody,
and you don't have to worry about hat hair.
And like if someone doesn't like it, like a joke, I just take the hat off and go, cancer. But go ahead, don't laugh at it. It could be the last set I do. But just for anyone that's listening, just so that you know, after 4 rounds last Friday, I got a diagnosis that the cancer has shrunk 90%, and I have 2 more rounds, which means that they should be able to eradicate it completely, and then I should be able to keep it at bay. Now, you never know with cancer; it's a gamble.
Right.
You know, it can pop up anywhere. There's no reason for me to have it genetically because no one in my family's ever had it. My mom had lung cancer, but she went after it.
Mm-hmm.
She fairly went after. You know, she madmaned herself some cancer. But it was a surprise. It was a big surprise. But it was hard. The hardest part for me, I think, was how hard it was on Amira. It put a lot of pressure on her because it also was. It's been a bad financial strain because I lost a lot of money not touring Australia because I was supposed to stay there until like May 17th.
Right, you were going to do a road show and all sorts.
Yeah, I had
gigs.
A long road show. Like, and I had Sydney, and then I was going to come back here, and I had a pretty good chunk of shows here that I had to cancel. But
also, you're involved in the American medical system. That, which I've read some stuff about the fact that that isn't as cheap as it could be.
Here's what they do. They put, and I'm not even shitting you, and you have to be careful if you get sick here. They put a barcode on your wrist, and then they ding you every time they do something while you're laying in bed. So let's say you're laying in bed, and they go, we're going to give you some anti-nausea stuff in your IV, and they hook up your IV, and then they go, let me see your wrist, and then they ding it, and then it charges you. So sometimes they would wake me up to give me like OxyContin when I was already sleeping on Dilaudid.
Right.
And I would go, no, 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 I'm good. Or I don't want any more stool softener, like, because I don't want to be charged. My shits are fine. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? There was a point where you start to realize you're just ringing stuff up. I mean, right. I don't, and again, they're just doing what they do, but they charge you for everything. And you ask for a couple of aspirins thinking that the lady's just going to reach into her fucking purse and give you an aspirin, and then they got to go. They have to sign for it, then they come back and they have to open a closet. Everything's accounted for, and they bring it in a cup. And it was quite a production just to get a couple of aspirin. But because I didn't want a more expensive painkiller for, you know, one of the things I was going through. So it's unbelievable. The amount of money is just ridiculous. It's insane.
I don't want to pry too much here because it's probably getting a bit too personal.
I like talking about it.
Well, here's one thing though, and tell me just as much or as little about this as you care to.
Yeah.
But you mentioned like the hair and, you know, not wanting the girls to see your hair falling out. As a parent, when you're going through something like this, how much or how little do you end up telling your children about the process?
Well, the first weekend I came home from school, first weekend I came home from the hospital, the girls were away at a dance competition. They both dance competitively. So they were at a dance competition, and that was the worst weekend. Amira's parents were here with me, and so they didn't get to see I was throwing up blood. Like the first weekend was a mess. Then they just see you, and the thing with cancer is, and anyone knows who's had it, some days you just fucking look like shit.
Right.
Like you just look like the fucking walking dead. You are white, you are ashen, you are hollow looking. There's no amount of anything that will make you look like you're not dead. And sometimes they see you like that. You know, you're falling asleep and your head's back and your mouth's open and they think, you know. So it's hard for them. But we wanted them. So when we brought them home, we just straight up told them what it was. But that the doctor felt confident that it was something we could beat, but there are no promises. And, you know, we've been very gallows humor about it too. Like I'd say, give daddy a kiss, because when he comes back, he might be in a box. And sometimes they like those jokes and sometimes they don't, because they're very sensitive. But they pretended to be okay, and then they would go to their rooms and cry themselves to sleep. And I wouldn't find out about that till later. So it's tough. You know what I mean? And it's just something that they have to go through. But as we've gone through it, you know, they've gotten to just understand it's just one of those things that happens to people in life, you know. And also, I've never been home this much. Like, I've never been in the house and just home for weeks. And I think it's been one of the best things that's ever happened to the family. Like, we are just together all the time. And that I love.
It's interesting, isn't it? And I have experienced this recently myself, is that sometimes you can get a little out of rhythm with people who are close to you just from being away so much.
Yeah.
And sometimes it's almost tempting to spend less time or you know, go, this is too hard, this is not working or whatever, you know. Yeah. I mean in a broad sense, but I mean in the,
yeah.
But what you really need is to just be locked in the same house together for a while, because there is actually something about getting back that connection that involves actually putting some hours in, even if they're dead hours, even if they're nothing hours.
You just nailed it. Amir and I have a book coming out, which we've been getting the good, bad news all year long. The good news is they were so excited about the title that they want to put it out a year from now, like in 2016. It's supposed to come out this summer. And so you're like, well, we could have been making money anyway. But we're writing which I think will probably be my last relationship book, which is called How to Keep Your Marriage from Sucking.
Right.
And it's about all of the horrible things that have happened in our marriage and how we've blown it in so many different ways. And it's very comical and very funny and very open and very honest. And my part of we'll cover this, the cancer thing, is cancer is the best thing that's ever happened to our marriage, because we have spent a ton of time together. And it's exactly right. Like, we had to get reconnected in that way of like just being together all the time and like seeing each other every day. And I don't know. It's just been really good for us. I don't know how we would have done it any other way other than me being sick. I've always been close with my daughters. My daughters adore me. And so there's never been a disconnect there. And I also love I have two golden retrievers and they're fucking, I adore them and they're very close. But my wife and I have gone through periods of, you know, I'm gone so much that like, it's hard to have that full, robust relationship that you want to have with a woman or whoever you're in a relationship with. And it's gotten robust again. But not only that, like, we're laughing together a lot. And the gallows humor really worked. You know, the death stuff and, you know, I mean, she's really dark, my wife. And so that has been...
Well, she had all this material up her sleeve.
Oh, yeah, and she talks about her new husband. And, you know, there's been a lot of and me, you know, trying to get her to make me a sandwich because I'm dying. And, you know,
But it probably just gives you, I mean, genuinely gives you an excuse to talk to each other in a kind of more honest and direct way.
Yeah.
But with humor. And then that's bonding because, A, you're being more honest with each other.
Yeah.
Because I, you know, anyway, okay, so let's talk about relationships. Like, because, again, the book thing is always interesting to me.
Yeah.
Because you have written how many relationship books?
This will be our fourth.
Fourth.
Yeah.
And I feel like you have a complicated relationship with your relationship books. Not anymore. Not anymore.
That's all over with. I wish if I had been medicated the way I am now, I take a Wellbutrin and Zoloft, and I started that 2 years ago, and it changed my whole life. If I had been medicated during that process, I would have embraced it, because I would have understood that this is just part of who I am and not the whole thing, and I wouldn't have been such a crybaby about the whole thing. You know, it's tough when you get categorized as one thing, but I just would have done more stand-up. I just would have worked harder at stand-up, or I would have written more shit. The only thing that works in life, my belief is the only thing that works is work. That's it. The only thing is work and humility. That's the key. Work really fucking hard and be a humble human being. And if I had just worked really hard at being a comic during that period when people only thought I was a relationship guy, I'd have gotten through it. But instead, I threw a tantrum. I threw a fucking tantrum about it. Everyone thinks I'm the relationship guy and blah, blah. I mean, I really acted like a baby. And then people didn't want to be around me. And then I, you know what I mean? Like, and so I made that relationship complicated rather than going, look at my good fucking fortune. I didn't want to turn it into more of a thing. I didn't want to stay that guy because I don't like that world that, like, I love writing the books and I like having conversations like on a podcast. But like trying to turn it into a TV show, that doesn't interest me. You know, making a tonic and trying to sell it to people, or doing a late night infomercial, or all the different things that they told me I could do. That stuff, making an app, that stuff doesn't interest me. That feels like I'm squeezing people for more than they need, you know? And I like the reading of the books. That to me is what should be the main goal.
Okay, so talk to me about you mentioned the medication helping with your state of mind in regard to that. Has the cancer changed your perspective on anything? Because I mean, it's a cliche that, you know, you get really sick and you have certain changes of heart or changes of mind. Have there been things that have become less or more important?
Yes,
or
my envy and my petty differences with comics and my, like, all of a sudden I was just like, I'm just going to watch Maron's show.
Right.
I'm going to try everything.
Right.
I'm going to be inspired by people instead of afraid to watch it because I'm afraid I'll feel like I'm not funny. I'm going to go after people's things because that's what Will does. He loves comedy and he watches it. And I have a couple other friends that they embrace other people's comedy and I pretend to. And I don't. And I'm going to watch Amy Schumer and fall in love with her. And I'm going to watch stuff and I'm not going to like some of it. But I'm not going to not like it out of petty jealousy or my manager also manages them. But because it just doesn't make me laugh.
Yeah,
and so that's okay.
Getting to the place where you can not like something for the right reasons.
But I want to learn.
Yeah.
You know, this morning I went and I just watched as much Rory Scovel as I could watch because I just adore him. And I don't want to be him, but I want to learn from him. I want to learn what is something I can get from this. Because years ago, Bill Burr said, I learned how to slow down from watching Uncool. I learned how much time I could take from your special, you know. And it didn't sink in that, like, here's a comic who's turned himself into quite a comedy superstar. But he watched my special and then got something out of it. And then I started thinking, you got to stop with this jealousy. It's jealousy, you know? And so that kind of melted away, you know? I've never had that with music. I play in a band. simply so that I can just play in a band. And that's why I have a band. I have a band and I play music. So because I love it, and it's its own. Once we've been to band practice, that's exactly what I wanted to do. I've already satisfied the itch.
Yeah.
If we play a gig, it's even better. When I listen to the music in my car, where I'm done, it doesn't need to be more than that. It's exactly what it is. It doesn't have to be any bigger than that. You know,
That's a really interesting perspective, though, because it's something I've been asked quite a lot recently. I don't know. It's a theme that comes up, and I've been trying to reconcile my own thoughts about this, which is, often people ask me in an interview, and they're just interviewing. I'm not really judging them for asking me this, but they're always like, what's your aim? You know, what do you want to achieve in America? Why are you doing all these gigs? You want a TV show, or do you want like a movie, or what are you going to do next when you come back home? And what do you want to happen with the podcast? Or, you know, those sort of questions my honest answer to that is that mostly like everything that I want is kind of happening now. Like, I mean, it would be fine if all the things I'm doing, like if more people listen to the podcast or if more people came to the shows. But realistically, would I like my life to change much from what it's like now? No. I could play bigger venues, but I'd still do as many shows, you know, and I wonder if that but then I'm like, well, they're always thinking, oh, I should have more. Am I stupid to be satisfied with what I have? You know what I mean? Like, am I wrong? You know, which I don't think that I am, by the way. Like, but I think that there is a pressure more generally in society that you're constantly being told, don't be happy with what you have. And I think that a lot of people, if they actually looked around, would go, you know what? If I really think about it, like, what do I like to do with my day? Am I doing it? Then, okay, I'm pretty happy.
If I, you know, I just started, I have a new writing partner, and we wrote this show that we both really like, and I didn't want to pitch it because I didn't want to get a script deal because I didn't want to take notes, and I didn't want to end up with just like $3,000 after a summer of hard work.
Right.
So I said, let's write a script and then let's shoot two scenes from the script and then we'll take it around to places and we'll show them. But I want to show them proof. And also I learned how to, I've learned a little bit how to direct, but I want someone else to direct it, but I want to produce it and I want to cast it and I want to do the whole thing. And I have a vision and I want to have that adventure and I want to make it myself. And I want to, you know, and then I just want to see where that goes. I want something to happen with it but I want it to be good, but I also like that adventure. Like the reason I want to shoot it is I'm tired of waiting. I'm tired of asking people. I'm tired of I had such a fun time working on the show when I was in New York and working with actors and directing them and watching other people be the fucking main part of it and just me not being the main part of it and working with a crew every day. And I love being in big groups. And then Flanagan said, I want you to come and do the King Sweater every Wednesday in September. I think that song is hilarious. I love it. He made me do it at Largo during Sarah Silverman's show, and I did the little pieces of it that I could. And he said, I think it's fantastic. We got to turn it into something. So I'm just letting my life, I'm just doing the work and letting my life show me what it is. And I'm not asking, because here's what I was going to say about faith. This has made me believe less. I don't think I believe in God as such.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in other human beings, and I believe in work. And I believe if you just do really good work and that you stay connected to human beings, you don't isolate yourself, that life will just tell you what you're supposed to do. But you can't isolate yourself. You can't be alone. You can't be. I've been alone too much. I've tried to do things too much. And then I suddenly wake up and I'm not asked to do anything. When the Mr. Show reunion gets together, I'm not on it because I wasn't close enough with those guys. And I don't get to be on Marc Maron's show because I'm not close to Marc Maron at all. And I don't get to, you know what I mean? I didn't get to participate because I didn't extend myself and I didn't make friends and I didn't call people back and I didn't. So I feel like part of it is just community, being friends with people. Not disingenuously, but people like to work with people they love. And love is part of the whole community thing. And then hard work. That's the only thing that ever gets you anywhere is hard work. And if you love the work, which we both do, then you're there. You know what I mean?
Do you think that what you've been through with your illness will form a it will change your comedy at all? I mean, I imagine you are already and you will be talking about it because why wouldn't you talk about it? Like,
I have written some stuff about it. I mean,
at the very least, that's what the doctor in Australia should have said to you guys. Mate, you've got a show out of this.
Oh, no, the guy.
Yeah, congratulations. You've got a show and some tumors.
Apparently, when I was super high and I was back in the States, I told the surgeon the whole Australia story. And then when I went to see him in his office to have him look at the incision, he goes, if you don't do that Australia story on stage somewhere, you're nuts. You are hilarious. He goes, I saw Tig the other night and Sarah Silverman, and they were fantastic. And that story fits right up there. That's one of the best, you know. So I'll probably talk about it a little bit, and I'm sure it will inform my comedy. I'm interested to see what happens, but I'm more interested in doing comedy than I was before I left.
That's cool. I like that as an idea. Look, we could bang on for hours, but that's probably enough time because you've got a phone call in a few minutes. So tell people what should they check out? Where should they find you? Where are you at the moment? Like, as in, are you online? Are you releasing, or are you just taking a break from all those?
Yeah,
sort of
kind of like, I'm not really in or any on or anything, because I've been trying to figure out how to, like, everything will probably gear back up again in September. Uh-huh. My goal is to, like, rather than like get a club date and then do a Conan to support it, I'm gonna try and do a Conan to say I'm back doing stand up and get work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I'm going to try to, in September, I'm going to start doing I Am the King sweater at Largo and have it do it in the small room, the teeny tiny room where they can get 25 people in there, and start workshopping it and inviting friends to come and be a part of it and see what it turns into.
Well, that's a good one. So I know a lot of LA people listen to this podcast and also people who are fans of yours. So that's going to be a great thing to go out and
support. I'd like to get back to Australia and tell this story as it unfolds. You know, I'd like to go back and do a show proper again next year.
If people buy the books or, you know, those sort of things,
yeah.
Like, what's the best thing?
That's all Amazon.
All Amazon.
Amazon and any Goodreads or any of those places. The books are all there. And the new book's going to come out in a brand new way. So what we're doing is releasing it chapter by chapter.
Oh, nice.
But the chapters are the length of books.
Oh.
Short books. They're like, that's how they're doing this now. So this is sort of like a compendium. It's like there's like volumes.
Right.
So the first volume of how to, you know, is the engagement. And then the second volume is the wedding, and then the third volume is, and it's all our experiences, is the first year of marriage, and then we go through all the different stages of it, and I think it'll end up being like 10 chapters, and it'll come out over a year, and you can buy the whole thing at once, or you can buy them one chapter at a time, or you can just buy one chapter of it that's interesting to you. And this is the new wave of doing books. So we'll see how that turns out, but I'm kind of excited by it, you know.
I mean, we started, you know, talking about Marc Maron and Obama being on Marc Maron. It feels like a time that, even though we don't know what's going to happen still with, like, you know, podcasts and with new media, with the traditional networks. I mean, if you talk about the last 4 or 5 years, you know, even now, like when I left doing television in Australia 2 years ago, I'm going back to, you know, go and do my television show again next month. And television has completely changed in the time I've been away. Like, the numbers that you can do on, like, the way people watch TV. Yeah, right. People aren't watching it at 8:30 on a Wednesday night anymore. You know, like, they're watching it all, like, on, you know, on Catch Up or on Netflix or on whatever these sort of things are. That's all. Like, I've been away for 2 years and I'm going back into a completely different place. I find it exciting because I think all this, like, I'm the sort of person who thinks you can grab two microphones and make a show and this and just put it out, and that's a good thing to be able to do. And I love that, the opportunities, but nobody knows where any of this is going to go. But it does feel like at the moment we're in a point where
people are
trying a lot of new things, which is cool.
They are. Then a lot of good work's being done in television. No, who knew? Who knew that television was going to be the new place to see great? I mean, the work that's being done on television now.
It's amazing.
Some of the shows are just like, they're mind blowing. And then you're like, holy shit, I got to wait a whole nother year for Peaky Blinders to come back. Like, there's just some shows that I'm like, this is incredible. I guess I'm going to just watch it again until it comes back. I don't know what else to do. And, And then films, you know, you can go through and discover great independent films that didn't quite make it in the theaters, and you watch things at different times. I also do a lot of YouTubing. I do a lot of like just digging and spending. I mean, and that's the same as watching television right. anymore. So I like it. I think it's a really good time, and it is neat to be able to say to somebody, "Oh, Rory Scovel, yeah, check him out." And then
they can go and check him out.
My wife and I this morning were watching his first Conan set where he does it all in a country accent for no reason and talks about Lunchables. It's brilliant. It's like perfect. It's absolutely perfect. And he's such a nice, mm-hmm. such a nice man too. And it's so good. And it was so inspiring and it made me so happy. It was just such a great thing. So I love that that stuff's available to you and you can watch it any way you want. I don't have to wait for it to come on a comedy special or hope that I'm going to catch it later on or get charged for it somewhere, you know, that the Conan stuff is still around or whatever, you know, or you can watch it when it airs, but no, mostly people don't.
It's amazing. It's a really excellent time. It's a terrifying time. Like people, I mean, it's terrifying to know how we make a living doing what we do when content is free almost everywhere. But it's also a very creatively, yeah. If you've got an idea, you can make something right now.
You can, and you can, and you can, and they'll figure out a way. They'll figure out a way to advertise for it. Because the thing you have to remember is that people need to know where things are. You know, we do need advertisements. We do need to know. People need to know what medicines to take. People do need to know how to wipe their fucking ass. If the better ass wiping thing comes up, people need to know about it. It just is a fact. You know, advertisements do help. You don't think about it.
There's an exception to that rule. And every time that you get a spam email about, make your penis bigger, yeah. right? Okay, here's what I'm telling you. That's spam emails. Because if somebody comes up with a pill that makes your penis bigger, word of mouth will sort that one out.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. No. There's truth in that. But like, it truly is true. Like when I go to the, you know, like there is a little bit of like, we do sort of need that stuff a little bit. You do kind of, when you're walking into a fucking drugstore and you're like, what was the name of that fucking sinus thing? But I don't want the sinus cold thing. And you fucking heard it in an ad and you're like, oh, Mucinex. Mucinex is the one that's supposed to be good. And I got that off the television. And that's the only place I'm going to get it, and especially if my mommy's not here to take care of me. Do you know what I mean? So, I mean, there is something. So there will find some way to infuse it into, you know, and that shit costs money. They got to give it to us.
They
got to put it on our content.
That's a nice note to end on. If people want to catch me, all my dates are on my website, willanderson.com.au. Sydney and Perth are selling pretty fast in Australia if you want to come to those shows.
Yeah.
And I also have a little run of shows here in LA. You can catch me Saturday night at Nerd Melt doing my Free Will show. Gareth Reynolds is doing support for that show, so that should be really cool fun. Set list on Friday night. Madison, Wisconsin at Comedy on State next week. Toronto and Montreal the week after. And so just check out my website for all those details and dates.
That's fantastic.
Greg.
Yeah, you can at Gregory Barrett, is it? I think it's at Greg Barrett. Gregory Barrett. I'm on you can just find me on Twitter.
That's find him.
That's right there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you Instagramming still?
Yeah, I Instagram under the name Greg A Style, spelled like reggae style.
You're a good Instagrammer. I think it probably goes to the fact that you are a visually, you know, you have a visual style. Like Twitter I love. Instagram, I always like even forget that I have it. I'm like you get one a week.
That's the thing. I'm the opposite. Twitter makes me just go, oh, fuck, I don't know what to say. And then I'll read somebody else's tweet and go, well, that was what I wanted to say. And Instagram is like my fucking favorite. I love Instagram. I'll make a little movie or I'll fuck, you know, it's a great visual place. Also, I like watching people's lives. It's very, the thing I like about it is that there's not a lot of confrontation and not a lot of anger and not a lot of like, sometimes you read Twitter and you go, oh God, this is like a family feud.
There's a lot of hate. Yeah,
there's a lot of hate. There's a lot of angry people.
People are fighting over there.
Yeah,
for fun and for not fun.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there's fighting going on.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas it's very, very. I put up just a picture of my dogs this morning, but it's a good picture. You know what I mean? I don't just put up a horseshit picture. And I also spend a lot of time making sure that it's filtered right.
Right.
And, you know, and as it says on my arm, dress better. That's just a note to yourself. Note to self.
All right, mate. Thank you so much. And thanks, everybody, for listening. I'll talk to you again soon.
I gotta know, will you stay forever?